is a project that was done in collaboration with Rolf Albu and Bob Pape. The revision of the genus will be out in the next issue of Coleopt Bulletin. I'm going to talk today about these metapopulations in the Ischatomoxes. And I guess I should start by defining what I mean by metapopulation. For those of you who weren't at the symposium yesterday, there are a couple of books about them. And I would explain just by using an example of a familiar critter, the porcupine. Porcupines basically eat pine trees, so their habitat is pine forest. And in the western U.S., at least, the pine forests are found on the mountains, which are surrounded by deserts, which are not good porcupine habitat. And therefore, the population of porcupines are fragmented. And so these metapopulations are more or less isolated from other populations. And of course, isolation is one of the major factors driving evolution and speciation. But an important part of this concept is that the degree of isolation is not really complete. I remember the first time I saw a porcupine in Death Valley, I thought, what in the heck is a porcupine doing out here? And since then I've seen them several times, typically run over on I-10 or I-70. And the short answer is he's looking for the next Mrs. Porcupine. But part of that concept is that there is some gene flow. It's not just isolation in a physical sense, but also a temporal sense. So that if a population or metapopulation goes extinct, with time it might be reestablished. And that's the concept I want you to think about when I talk about the Ischatomoxes. This project began, like so many do, because somebody sent me a specimen to identify, and Bob Pate sent me a specimen which turned out to be Ischatomoxes, which was pretty remarkable at the time, because when we started this project, the only known specimens were the types of... in fact, the Ischatomoxes wagneri, the type species, was only known from a single holotype, which had been found dead in Death Valley. And a remarkable thing about it was when Blaisdell described it, he remarked that he believed the species would probably turn out to be subterranean. And this was based on a single dead specimen. I thought, well, what was the clues that gave away? What made him think that might be subterranean? Even more remarkable, it turns out he's probably correct, because when the next species was discovered, which was a Ischatomoxes tanneri from Utah, the types were taken out of a pack rat mound. And except for two of the specimens were actually dug out of a cliff swallow nest. So somebody was out there looking for vertebrate, invertebrate nests, and they found these beetles. A few years after Blaisdell described the Ischatomoxes wagneri, he published another paper in which he said a second specimen had been found in Riverside County. And so my colleague Rolf Albu traipsed over there at Cal Academy and took a look at it, and this is what he found. And it's a different species, and it's an undescribed species. We're describing it for Fred Andrews because he got a series in pitfall traps. I can work the mouse here. Notice that this species has a complete marginal bead here separating the dorsum from the ventral part of the pronotum, whereas in wagneri, it does not have a marginal bead. In fact, Blaisdell used the lack of a marginal bead here as a character for describing the genus. So what he was smoking when he thought that was the same species, I'd like to get some. But the other thing I want to point out about wagneri, note the size of the eye. And as good taxonomist, for perspective, let's compare the distance to the cervix here. So the greatest ocular diameter is about equal to the distance to the cervix. And compare that to the species that we got, that Bob Pape found, which the ocular diameter, there were at least two ocular diameters in the cervix here, a much smaller eye. And this beetle was found in a cave. And it was found in a place called Bat Cave, not because Batman operates out of there, but because of a large population, over a million Mexican free-tailed bats that live in that cave. It also has, you'll notice, it does not have a complete marginal bead, but it does have kind of a ruga here on the pronotum. So this is an undescribed species that we're naming Foleater. Well, and I get back to what Blaisdell might have been looking at. There's a convergence in cave beetle morphology. They tend to have a fiddle shape with long legs, and of course these true cave beetles, troglophilic beetles are blind, they have no eyes. So our beetle, he's not there yet, but he does have reduced size of the eyes. Now this is the cave. When we told the National Park Service in Grand Canyon that we're going to describe a new species from Bat Cave, they asked, would you please not put the locality in the description? Which of course we can't do that. But the reason was because they're afraid that, well, they're talking about you guys, you dastardly beetle collectors will go there and wipe out the population. Well, I invite you to go there because to get to this cave, you're going to have to crawl 600 feet of a cliff, and to get to the base of the cliff, you're going to have to take about a 10-day whitewater raft trip down the Colorado River to get to that point. So I'm going to take you on a virtual beetle collecting trip into the cave here. This is Bob Pape's expedition financed by the National Park Service to survey the fauna of this cave, and I'm going to have a little story to talk about that scaffold, that structure that's down there at the base of the cave here. And here's Bob Pape as he's about to enter into our Bat Cave. Back in prior to the 1965, the Bat Cave was actually exploited for guano. They mined the guano out of that cave. Like I say, there's over a million Mexican free-tailed bats that occupy the cave. And in order to do this, incredibly enough, if you look across the canyon, you can just make out that scaffold down there over here, which is on the north rim. They ran a cable across the canyon to this structure here, winch housing, that had this large bucket that they would fill with the guano and tote it across the here to what they call Guano Point. Now you can imagine how many beetles were in that guano, which is one of the points I'm trying to make on this part of the story. This all ended in 1965 when one of our top guns from Nellis Air Base decided to buzz the canyon and didn't know that the cable was there. Took out the cable, took out his jet, ended tragically for the pilot, and they never restarted the guano operation. In fact, now the Park Service, in order to restore the canyon to its natural site, this is now a restaurant, and the Navajo tribe has put out a skywalk here, which will be probably the closest I'll ever get to Bat Cave. I know Chuck Triplehorn will be on the next whitewater trip out. Anyway, so let's go into the cave and take a look. This is the beetle in its habitat in the cave. The floor of the cave is covered with the bat guano and dead bat skeletons. Bob mapped out the localities where he could actually find the... Each circle represents where he found a beetle. He didn't collect them all. He just marked where he found them. This is about 200 meters from the entrance back to this constriction. The bats used to roost back in here, but the guano piled up so high that they cut themselves off from here. So now the main roost is in this area here. And you can see that the beetles are found well back into the cave and in this guano. We never found the larvae. This was only one expedition and entrance into the cave. We suspect it's sort of like Alphatobius, that the larvae are in the guano but don't actually eat the guano, but undigested material that's in the guano. But of course that's conjecture. This is what the adults do feed on, the dead bats that fall to the floor of the cave. And again, part of the cycle of life here, we've got there's a cave spider that lives in the cave. It makes its nest up on the walls of the cave, and then below these nests you find these detritus piles, and then going through the detritus piles you find the dead carcasses of the beetle. So it seems in our cycle the beetle is the main prey for the cave spider. Simple little ecosystem. The obvious question then is this beetle found in other caves? It turns out that in the Grand Canyon National Park, within the confines, there are at least 400 caves. And one of the reasons is because of the permeable rock that makes up, you know, the famous layer cake structure here. Down here you have the great nonconformity. Just above that you have this really hard shale layer. And then what happens is the water percolates to the permeable rock, and it gets to that hard shale and it comes out sideways. So a lot of the caves are in this Mauve limestone layer. And this is that Mauve limestone area. This is the north south rim along the Kaibab Trail, and you walk down that trail and you come to a famous cave called the Rampart Cave. And interestingly not enough, there are no bats in this cave, but a Chattamoxie foliator is in this cave. It's fenced off to keep the two-legged snakes out. The Park Service is very protective of these caves, and as we go into the cave and look back out towards the entrance, I direct your attention to that the shelf area over here, and you'll see these boluses are actually the dung of the extinct fossil sloth that had occupied the cave, and that's where we find our beetles, is in the extinct sloth dung. This is the critter that left it, one of three genera of extinct giant sloths that lived during the Pleistocene here. And of course, we have to have our creation museum version of the artist decided to draw himself in to give you some perspective of the size. It's about the size of a cow, and of course he got the habitat wrong because during the Pleistocene it was a pine juniper forest, not desert as it is now. And you understand that the sloth did not live in caves. This is not a cave animal. What happened is about 14,000 years ago, the clan of the cave bear showed up and began decimating the megafauna, and the sloth was just such easy prey for them that instead of just slaughtering them, they herded them down into the cave and corralled them in the cave as in a sort of a semi-domestic situation so that, you can have a hot meal when Thanksgiving comes around, whenever the dearth season. And inside the cave, you still find the remains, the skeletal, and even the fur from the cave. Well, this presented the natives with a waste disposal problem. So what they did was they took the sloth dung and piled it up in the back of the cave. So you got a 6-foot pile of sloth dung in the back of the cave, and that's where the beetles were found. The problem is that somebody tossed a cigarette in there, and it's kind of like a coal seam fire that once it started to smolder, there was no way to put it out. So it burned for 22 years, and finally, after some 70% was destroyed, the fire finally went out. But so you can see why they want to keep people out of these caves. But I digress. So far we found this beetle in four caves, very widely distributed. One of them, the Rampart Cave, is right across the rim. All these other caves are on the north rim, and the people who have studied the cave faunas have found a distinct difference at the species level between the fauna in the north rim and the south rim. So the Colorado acts as a sort of a barrier. And we have found it in one cave in the south rim, and I can't help but wonder if all that buckets of guano moving across the canyon might have had. Now, we think about Tenebrionis being spread around the world, dispersed by foodstuffs that we've moved around. We had maybe hadn't thought about our guano export business, but... So this is that idea of metapopulation, because you wonder, with this beetle we've only found in inside caves so far, but and yet here these are hundreds of miles apart, so how do they, is there any kind of gene flow from one to the other? Obviously we think there's a lot more caves that have these beetles and that they sometimes wander out. But the second part of my study, and my colleague Rolf Albu got involved with a study of the fauna of the Midriff Islands of the Gulf of the Sea of Cortez, and sure enough, found in the Chattamoxies on one of these islands in the Gulf Sea of Cortez. You'll notice the acute angles of the pronotum here, unlike those other species, a complete marginal bead. And these are found in these little islands offshore. These are bird islands, and the reason is, of course, because the seabirds can nest on these islands. They're away from the coyotes or the raccoons that would feed on the nestlings and the eggs. And so these islands become covered with a resource, guano, which is, in fact, mined by the Mexicans that come out there. And this is where Rolf found these Chattamoxies. So there seems to be a connection. We haven't found a larva yet, but there seems to be a connection with this vertebrate excrement. I don't know if you've ever heard of these booby piles. The boobies will sit in one place generation after generation and pile up the guano, and this is mined. The Mexicans collect these booby piles. So far, we found the Chattamoxies paco This was found on the Bay of Los Angeles, LA Bay. It's known from six islands so far. And then a second species turned up, the Chatamoxys rosei, down in the San Lorenzo group of islands, and there's four down there. So I guess there was enough isolation for speciation there, and yet you still have them on multiple islands. These are flightless beetles, so they can't fly from one island to the other. And of course, I don't think they can swim too well, but then maybe these guano collectors are moving things around. So I don't have the answers, but it's an interesting question. I want to end with a little advertisement. A lot of us that do pitfall trapping use capture liquid, use antifreeze for capture liquid. I hope you do know ethylene glycol is a deadly poison, and then you probably shouldn't leave your traps open where it has access to pets, wild animals, that sort of thing. Some of you know that, are using maybe the propylene glycol, which is non-toxic. You can get the low tox, but actually it's not the propylene glycol, it's a lot of the additives in there. So it's only about 1/4 as poisonous as the two teaspoonfuls will kill your pet of the ethylene glycol. I recommend, we've been testing this in our lab. You can buy go down to your RV store, get your household swimming pool antifreeze. Propylene glycol doesn't have all those toxic additives. The preservation is just as good. In this case, however, since it doesn't have all the additives, you've got to add one or two drops of dishwashing detergent for a surfactant. Make sure they'll immerse in the fluid and get your preservation. And thank you very much for your attention.